the national anthem of the Islamic Republic of Iran since 1979 and its takeover in the Islamic Revolution, introducing us here to another episode of Conservative Casual Friday on Blog Talk Radio with your show host, Andrew Harrod, where every Friday we like to examine important current events in our world for conservatives and others. And today we want to be talking about Iran and the Islamic Republic's oppressive rule of its southwestern province along the Gulf, the Arab or Persian Gulf, depending on your perspective, and how it's named. The province of, as the Iranians have called it, Khuzestan, or otherwise known, however, as Arabistan by its Ahwaz Arab minority that lives in the area. And to discuss this issue, this important province where most of Iran's oil and gas wealth comes from, with its rest of Arab minority in the history of this province, we are joined by Aaron Eitenmeyer, a lawyer and former research director for the Law Project, who has studied extensively and written about the Al-Ahwaz Arab minority in Iran in Khuzestan province. Well, Aaron, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, this is a really interesting issue, perhaps something that many people haven't learned about Iran's various ethnic minorities, and in particular this Arab minority in the strategically sensitive province. Well, just for our listeners here, describe the Ahwaz Arab minority and this province of Khuzestan, rather, and its history.
So where to begin? If you go back a couple of thousand years ago, you'll find Herodotus and Josephus and all of the other commentators talking about the various peoples that lived near the ancient kingdom of Elam, the city of Shushan that we know from the Purim story. And there was a basically ethnically Arab minority and certainly a Semitic people living there for thousands of years. We can skip through a bit of that out of necessity. But basically, we would have to begin with the battles between the Ottoman and the Persian empires that spanned a couple of hundred years, at least the last part of it. And basically, they were fighting in part over the border between the two empires. So, you know, to a Western audience who loves talking about colonialism, so long as it can be blamed on the European powers, well, we've got a wonderful example from the East that has led to much greater problems that no one is even looking at. Basically, what happened was the Ottoman Empire was looking to shore up its eastern border, while the Persian Empire was ensuring that its western border was protected. And the key was the river, the Shatt al-Arab, which comes off of the Arabian Gulf, which has become known as the Persian Gulf lately. And the two empires basically discussed how to apportion the land and the tribes and the resources at that time. And the most important was navigable rights. The Shatt al-Arab River was the most important thing. And basically the Ottoman Empire ceded it along with its people to be under the Persian control under basically a feudal system. This happened finally with the second treaty of Erzurum in 1847. What happened after that is really where the horrific start of this particular story would take place, because in the late 19th century, they started discovering oil in that area. So here you had, Ahwazi tribes who had lived there for hundreds and thousands of years, much as you had the Baluchi people more to the east, you had the Kurds to the north, and all of these indigenous people suddenly became under a different control. And instead of the Shatt al-Arab and its navigable waters being so critical, suddenly the land itself was home to oil. And that, unfortunately, led to the end of an independent Al-Ahwaz. Arabistan was basically finished by 1925 when you had what could fairly be called the Persian conquest of Persia and the birth of modern Iran. Which then was intensified when the Ayatollahs took over in 1979.
Yes. Well, speaking of this Al-Ahwaz population, how large are they, and what proportion of the population of this Now, Khuzestan province, it was so named by Reza Shah Pahlavi in 1936, if I recall correctly, what the Alakwas refer to as Arabistan, stressing, of course, that their Arab roots and heritage in the region. What sort of population are we talking about, and what percentage now of the provincial population are the Arabs?
Well, and I would say the answer is Ahwazis. And I should probably clarify that, not all Ahwazis are entirely Arab. There was a Jewish population there that was pretty numerous up until 1979, and some other Semitic peoples that could be included, which makes it even more difficult to give an exact number. But we're talking millions of people. Let's not forget, everybody overlooks the fact Iran is at most perhaps 49% ethnically Persian. There is a reason we do not have useful official statistics coming out of Iran about its own minority populations, because they are not generally Persian. And the Ahwazis would be a perfect example of, probably millions of people who are effectively erased.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting statistic. I came across such statistics that recently, looking at the map and thinking of Iran, it strikes me that these non-Persian groups are really sort of in strategic places on the outer edges of Iran. I mean, we're talking about here this Khuzestan or Arabistan province with the Alakwazi Arabs on the southwest on the border with Iraq, and this rich in oil and gas. Then you have the Azeris that border up on with the border with Azerbaijan to the north, and as you mentioned, the Baluch who border are on the border with Pakistan, where the Baluch are both in people are in both Pakistan and Iran. So and the Kurds, of course, as well, that are on the northeastern border of Iran with Iraq and alongside the other Kurdish people inside Iraq. So you have all these minority populations, I guess, that are sort of surrounding the periphery of what we call Iran, but the actual Farsi speakers, Iranians, ethnic Iranians, are more in the center of the country. So it must be a really strategically sensitive issue for Iran.
That's absolutely correct, and I would say Al-Ahwaz would be the most critically important for a couple of main reasons. One, if you look at where it's situated, the border with Iraq and the oil fields, the natural gas fields, all of those natural resources, that's something like 90% of Iran's resources right there, 90-something percent. So when you talk about the land itself, it is critically important to Iran, even as much as it hates the people that live there. In terms of military matters, the Iran-Iraq war was basically fought through that area, which made it critical then. And again, I think I've mentioned in the past that the CIA identified Al-Ahwaz as a potential Achilles heel as far back as the 1950s based on declassified documents. You look at its border, and then, of course, yeah, you're talking about the Arabian Gulf. So they're looking across the river at the other Arab countries that are there, and saying that it's critically important might even be an understatement, at least as uniquely so as far as Iran is concerned.
Yeah, and thinking about these Al-Ahwaz Arabs, what sort of links do they have then to the Arabs in neighboring Iraq? What sort of similarities or linkages are there?
Well, there are certainly linkages. It's actually something of a smear that the Iranian government has tried to play at times, saying, oh, they're no different from their cousins across the river and they will join with them. It is actually a shock to Saddam Hussein as well in the 1980s that he didn't suddenly get welcomed with open arms, because they were understandably concerned about his own ambitions to turn Al-Ahwaz into basically an oil cow, another oil cow for Iraq, as he had tried to do to Kuwait before that, so really, there are longstanding relationships that date back millennia, as to the UAE, Saudi Arabia, But one of the big mistakes that is often made is to just assume that they have, you know, this indelible linkage where they really are a distinct population in and among themselves as well.
Yeah, I found that interesting, too, reading about the Iran-Iraq war from 1980 to 1988. And indeed, Saddam Hussein in Iraq invaded Iran precisely through this Khuzestan, Arabistan province. And there was sort of this expectation, oh, these Arabs would want to rise up against the Persians, the Iranians, and support Saddam Hussein. But as you and others have noted, that didn't happen. Why was that? As you say, it was because they didn't trust Saddam Hussein that he would also be just another brutal ruler.
I would say that that's part of it. And also, don't forget, you know, Iran has for many years, and especially, you know, since Khomeini and his ilk took over, you know, they've systematically turned just about everybody into a potential fifth column. And the Ahwazis have suffered from that particular smear more than anyone else. So, you know, when they were presented with a war that was going to be fought on their land, and let's make no mistake, you had oil refineries that were being attacked with Scud missiles. You know, this was a deadly time for them. That's not really the time to start trying to, you know, choose allegiances in the heat of battle, even if it is available. If you look at Iranian military records, at least the handful of trustworthy ones that one can find, that also underscores that there wasn't really much of an opportunity for them to do much. They were basically being, you know, shunted out of cities and moved here and there. Unless it was useful for Iran to keep them in place as the missiles were raining overhead.
Well, thinking of this Al-Aqwa's population, do they have much of an international presence? Is there a diaspora of Al-Aqwa's Arabs, and where are they located, and what groups do they have?
There certainly is. I can say that, you know, my friends and colleagues at the Durantash Study Center are throughout North America. There's a significant Ahwazi populace in Europe, as well as Australia. They just had protests probably a few hours ago in Australia over the latest regime brutality against their people. You'll also find it occasionally in Europe because, unfortunately, certain governments there are less than I was trying to think of a nice way to say it, but they bow down to Iran and periodically will identify Ahwazis or other dissidents as terrorists or who knows what, and basically hand them up to Iran on a silver platter.
Well, you mentioned your work, your involvement with the Durantash Study Center. I believe that's located in Canada. Describe that and what its history and what it's done.
Certainly. I discovered them probably about a little over 2 years ago. For anybody who wasn't really aware, periodically there's massive flooding that goes through the region. The Karun River is a major river. And unfortunately, it has been dammed and the water's diverted for decades. Basically, a lot of the water is shunted off towards ethnically Persian areas. As a result of these floods, what happened was even worse, because the Iranian regime purposely diverted floodwaters towards Ahwazi villages and farms, which is part of a longstanding effort to compel them to leave. It's forced migration. It's actually flagrantly illegal under international law, but somehow they get away with it. And in the course of reviewing a number of issues involving Iran and foreign policy, I came across the Durantash Center, and you know, we began working together. And I can say that while it is incredibly difficult for any information to come out of Iran, they have been instrumental in documenting things for years, translating into English, into Arabic, into Farsi, and it's really been it's been a privilege to work with them.
Well, interesting. Talking about, we've mentioned here that, you know, this harsh Iranian rule over the Ahwazis. Describe the nature of Iranian rule over these Ahwazi Arabs throughout history. How's it varied from, say, the Shahs to the Islamic Republic?
Well, the words from bad to worse come to mind. As I wrote in a paper not that long ago, dealing with the end of an independent Arabistan, when after oil was discovered, what happened was Sheikh Khazal ibn Jabir, who was the last independent ruler of Al-Ahwaz, basically he had British assurances that he and his lands and his people would be secure, and in return he would ensure that these critical oil refineries, because again, already 100 years ago, these were among the largest in the world. He ensured that that would keep going. Unfortunately for them, when Reza Khan started his conquest, for lack of a better word, they suddenly found that Great Britain was no longer interested in upholding its bargain, and there was war. This has been in many ways a belligerent occupation since certainly 1925, which is when he was deposed. He was pulled off of a boat that was actually on the Kurun River and taken to Tehran, where he mysteriously died alone in his house several years later. So basically, you had under the Shah, you already had a movement towards the Persianization of Iran. And of course, having this distinctive minority population with their own customs, with their own chieftains, with clothing, with the Arabic language, with a lot of Sunni Islam rather than Shia necessarily, that was already going to be an issue for them under the Shah, who began a concerted campaign of Persianizing the entirety of the country. Worse yet, when Khomeini took over in 1979, as we know, well, that was a totalitarian ideology. There could be only Khomeini's Shia. The government was going to be Khomeini's Shia. Religion would be, customs would be, everything would be. And so what you saw was the Arabic language has been brutally suppressed. For the crime of teaching or spreading Arabic language, people have been imprisoned, tortured, and killed for 40 years. For daring to wear their national, the customary outfits, these beautiful garments that date back hundreds or thousands of years. Again, punishable. And of course, for those who were not visibly Shia Muslim in the Khomeini sense, they too were singled out for particular reprisal. So what you have is an increasingly escalating campaign of suppression and erasure, really.
Yeah, one phrase I've come across in some of the writings is linguicide, if I'm pronouncing that right, genocide, as it were, of a language, of a lingua franca. Sound interesting to try to erase someone's culture and their language. Now, you speak of Sheikh Khazal ibn Jabbar, and from the time of the 1847 Treaty of Erzurum between the Ottoman and the then Persian empires up until this 1925 institution of central Iranian rule under Reza Shah. What was then the official status of all these Arab tribes in Arabistan?
Thank you for asking that. That is exactly the subject of my recent article, From Cession to Conquest. So as a matter of international law, when you have treaties and you have one great power ceding lands to the other, it's that they acquire the territory by quote-unquote right of cession. Empire A called Empire B, you can have this and I get that. What is interesting and overlooked is the particular treaties that we're talking about included specific mention of the tribes that live in these disputed regions on, basically to either side of the Shatt al-Arab. And it specifically said that the tribes whose allegiance was known would move towards that empire, and anyone else could choose based on where they ended up. And the term there is suzerainty, which is a little imprecise. It was a phrase that was in vogue in the 19th century, and denoted some sort of almost feudal relationship, where they had a degree of autonomy, but they owed their ultimate allegiance to whichever empire was overseeing them. In the Ottoman sense, that was how they governed, you know, many of their territories. I mean, otherwise, think about how a Turkish empire could control a broad swath of the world, you know, with the light hand that it did. It was a critical part of its own strategy. So the Ahwazi tribes and others, basically, they continued to exist as they had, with their independence, with their control over their lands and their territories. But their overall allegiance was then given to whichever empire ended up in control. So for the Ahwazis, that ended up being the Persian Empire, unfortunately for them.
Okay, so they were then, under the treaty in 1847, they were conceded as being on this Persian land, but they were supposed to, according to treaty, they were supposed to have a certain, the treaty then granted them certain autonomy rights, which were then, as you say, crushed by Reza Shah in 1925.
Yeah, I would say that the treaty acknowledged them. I'm a little didactic, I know. But when it comes to a treaty of that sort, you know, they weren't a party to the treaty. So I would say that involvement was limited to the treaty acknowledging their prior existence, their prior autonomous state. And again, it was in very many ways almost a feudal type relationship, and just said, okay, their allegiance will belong to whoever controls it, which may sound semantic, but between, you know, certainly 1847, and then there were subsequent treaties as well, leading up to and even following World War I, that ultimately all fell apart by 1925, when it was a military conquest that ended it.
Yeah, but, you know, it's interesting. I think of this. You talk about how the British had sort of a relationship where Sheikh Khazal Ibn Jabbar had said to them, "Yeah, you know, just have your oil interests here, build your oil refineries, and you know, we'll support that, we'll help protect that." But then later, the centralizing government from Tehran came and crushed any sort of autonomy for these Arabs. Yeah, it strikes me. I wonder what did these Arabs in the province then have any particular reaction to? You know, it's always talked about Iranian history in 1953 that the Mossadegh government was nationalizing Iranian oil interests from British Petroleum, and then the British and the Americans helped sort of instigate or facilitate this overthrow of Mossadegh. Was there any particular reaction of the Arabs in this now Khuzestan province towards the overthrow of Mossadegh in 1953?
I mean, certainly there was when you have any sort of regime changing over, but unfortunately for them, it didn't really make a difference. You know, the bait and switch happened when British Petroleum basically said, "Oh, we'll stand aside because we'll be protected." And I'm jumping ahead a bit in time, but if you're looking at current Chinese foreign policy, it was in many ways a little reflective of that concept. We don't care what you do within your country so long as our interests are preserved.
Mm-hmm. Well, and thinking of, you know, you mentioned the distinct culture of these Ahwazi Arabs. How do Iranians view the Ahwazi, and for that matter, Arabs in general? I mean, what sort of dynamics come into play there when you're talking about this minority facing this majority Persian culture?
Well, considering a prominent Iranian scholar who's affiliated with the mullahs felt free to go on national TV yesterday and denigrate Arabs as basically backwards, barely human, I would say the word racism comes to mind in its most blatant and horrific connotations. So you have, I wish I could have found it for you, although it's not translated into English, I don't believe. It's part of a long-standing issue. So you have Arabic is prohibited from being taught. You have students whose Persian, so Ahwazi students whose Persian isn't necessarily up to par, and they are, this happened about a year ago, classified as mentally deficient. You have, people, of course, if you're Ahwazi, you probably can't get work either. So there's no schooling, there's no work. And this is, again, a deliberate outcome. And so they're left basically from a young age not even being able to obtain the education. And then the regime uses that to turn around and say, of course, oh, look at them. They know nothing. And that, of course, extends to Arabs a little more generally. The Iranian government uses certain Arab states, as we know, Syria, Iraq, its various affiliates like Hamas and Hezbollah. But if you really get down to it and you look at what they say about Arabs, it's pretty nasty.
Yeah, is there, I guess, a sense there? My perception, perhaps, of Iranian history is, given that they have such a long-standing pre-Islamic history, and they've been the seat of like empires of, going back to. I'm trying to think of Osiris, Osiris the Great, of course, and others. Do they have this sense of, we have this heritage of a great civilization, whereas Arabs are just sort of these tribes people who came out of the Arabian Peninsula, and so they would always look down upon all Arabs.
There's certainly something of that, and also, cultural, what would be a good word, cultural co-option. Where the Persian government is saying is basically taking the Elamites and these other ancient Semitic kingdoms and holding them out as ancient Persian kingdoms. We of course, we'll sometimes reference them as Persian ourselves for lack of a better term, but really if you get back far enough in history, that's inaccurate. And that's unfortunately, as we've seen, not just with the Ahwazis, but certainly being Jewish, I'm very keenly aware of how the Iranian government has treated Jewish holy sites under its control. A degree of, either it didn't matter or we're going to take credit for it. And if you say otherwise, we'll destroy it.
Yeah. Thinking of the Ahwazi in this, under this repression, what would be the goals of the Ahwazi today? Do they want autonomy or independence, or what sort of political future are these Ahwazi Arabs thinking of or striving for?
Well, I'm hesitant to speak for them collectively, of course, but I would say you probably have a range of opinions. I think none of them want to remain under the Ayatollah's control. I think that's the easy starting point. This campaign of suppression, of brutality, of torture, imprisonment, killings, I think the first thing is that they want that to end, and it needs to end. And then second would be basically just to be given the choice that's been taken from them for almost 100 years, the right to say, what do we want? Unfortunately, what we have seen is that international law remains less law and more about leverage power. And so I'm hesitant to give even more of an answer than that, because they deserve autonomy. They deserve the right of sovereignty. They deserve to choose confederation, even if they so desired. China now officially buying that whole region from Iran in order to satisfy its own critical oil needs. The odds of that actually being allowed to happen are very small, especially so long as the United States isn't willing to do anything about it.
Well, what is the relationship then of these Ahwazi towards any other opposition movements in Iran?
Well, I can certainly state that they are very keenly aware of the Baluchis and the Azeri struggles, the Kurdish struggles to a large degree. They're all, to some extent, bound together in being suppressed by the Iranian government. They're particular issues may vary slightly. You know, you may have noticed that just recently a number of Baluchis were gunned down at the border as they were trying to trade. They were trying to to keep trade going back and forth around the the border with Iran, and they were gunned down. The Ahwazis, of course, expressed outrage and condolences, and of course they can understand that too, because the same exact thing happens to them as they try to trade across the Iran-Iraq border. So when I say opposition in that way, I'm referring to the various minority groups. There's also, of course, more than one, I should say. You know, you have the Mujahideen e Khalq, you have, descendants of the Shah who are still standing opposed to Iran, which have their own agendas and their own issues with the other groups, of course. The only group that I'm leaving out would be what's popularly called the Iranian opposition. You and I both know that when we see publications talk about, oh, the moderates in Iran, it's laughable. That's the only group that I will say is not really opposition.
Yeah, certainly. Yeah. I don't, the claims that within the regime there's some sort of division in the Islamic Republic of Iran between the proverbial moderates and hardliners is really overblown. I think farcical. But it's, it strikes me that this is such an essential province for wider Iran. As you've noted, I mean, statistics that I've come across say that some 80% of Iran's oil production comes from Iran, from this Khuzestan or Arabistan province, along with 50% of its natural gas. It seemed to me that any other populations, I mean, certainly plurality of Persians, Farsi-speaking Iranians, along with any other populations that would seek to stay in any sort of united Iran, they would really not want this province to break off. So I guess it could be a thorny subject for even other opposition groups as to what they might be willing to allow or wish for this strategic province.
Exactly right, and that's part of the reason that that Iran has clung so strongly to the territory, even as it's done everything it could to rewrite it demographically. And one of the ways that it's done it, of course, is to import a number of Persian workers and creating, these all settlements where Persian workers are induced to come over. They're allowed to work. The higher executives, in many cases, fly back and forth from Tehran, and the local Ahwazis are basically excluded from any sort of work in these refineries or really anywhere else that's controlled by the government.
Yeah, well, you speak of settlement, and of course, you and others have indicated that the local population of Ahwazi there. They're really excluded from any jobs in the economy, in the oil industry in particular. There's often talk, they say, look, we live in this oil-rich province, but we don't really benefit from it. One quotation I came across was from an Ahwazi who said, all we get from these oil refineries, from this oil industry is just the smoke and the pollution. What do people around the world, particularly like other Arabs in the Middle East or other Muslims in the Middle East, we often hear all this talk about Israeli settlements and Palestinians, living under Israeli apartheid. Do people among the wider Arab world or the wider Muslim world, do they notice much what's going on with the Ahwazi in Iran?
I would say not as much as there should be. We've certainly seen something of a sea change over the past really 20 years. Most visibly recently would be the Abraham Accords. If you'll talk to a number of Ahwazis, they'll express frustration at that too. One complaint that I've heard a number of times was, we're told that Iran is the protector of the Arab peoples, right? They say they're protecting Syria, they're protecting Lebanon through Hezbollah, through Hamas, they're standing up for the Palestinian people. And the Ahwazi who's standing there in the dirty remains of what used to be his home, what used to be his field, seeing his livestock being killed off by basically the excretions from these plants. And he's standing there saying, well, you're taking all of this oil, you're taking all of this revenue, and you're sending it to them, and you're calling them your protectees. You're talking about being the savior of Arabs, and this is what you do to the actual Arabs that you control. Calling that hypocritical would be an understatement. But it's an inconvenient fact, unfortunately.
Yeah, I guess that brings up the question. I mean, what are these Iranian proxies? I mean, think about particularly the Shiite Arab Hezbollah in Lebanon, as well as, you know, Hamas, the Sunni Arab Muslim Brotherhood movement in the Gaza Strip. They've also received Arab backing. I mean, are they ever confronted with this issue? How do they deal with this issue of this plight of the Ahwazi Arabs and other minorities in their state sponsor of Iran?
Well, you know, for the likes of Hezbollah, they don't really say anything because I remember a year ago there were some protests because periodically the Ahwazis, especially some of the young men, you know, who are destitute and facing a life of you know, starvation and horror, will protest. And wouldn't you know, a lot of the time what the Iranian government does, instead of just bringing down the Iranian Revolutionary Guard, which is their other go-to move, they actually brought down convoys of Hezbollah operatives and other militias so that they could say, oh, look, we're not doing anything. And, you know, and they violently suppressed some of these protests as well.
Well, that's interesting. So they'll actually take Hezbollah operatives in Iran, say, for training purposes or such, and they'll use them to repress various protests from the Ahwazi in Khuzestan or Arabistan. That's very interesting. And they want to show, like, that they're Arabs on Iran's side that way.
Yeah, and, you know, it's a better visual than, for example, when the unlamented Qasem Soleimani went there and was briefly heckled, actually, especially considering that he was personally responsible for ordering the torture and execution of any number of Ahwazis. You know, after he was heckled when he went there, yeah, the next time you had Hezbollah flags flying over a convoy of vehicles, whether it came from Lebanon or from Iraq, from that branch. I couldn't say offhand, but, you know, there's a very distinctive Hezbollah flag, and when you see that convoy coming into town from the video that was able to get out, it sends the message, but unfortunately nobody was really looking.
That's interesting. So I guess once again Hezbollah is manifesting this loyalty towards this Shiite Islamic power in suppressing this other Arab community. Well, has that had any effect on the religious feelings of the Ahwazi? I mean, historically, I've seen figures that they're a majority Shiite population, like the Shiite Arabs in Iraq, something like 70% Shiite, and maybe about some 24% or so. I've seen Sunni with others, I guess, not affiliated or so. Has that had any effect upon the religious sentiment of the Ahwazi facing this repression from this Shiite Muslim power along with its proxies like Hezbollah?
I would say none of them sincerely adhere to Khomeini's Shia. That's the easy part. And I would say it's possible that a number are only superficially Shia to begin with because it was imposed on them. You know, to be Sunni is to be an extra threat. And, you know, so you have a population, they've already got, you know, six or seven strikes against them as far as the Iranian government's concerned. So, you know, I'm hesitant to give any credence to any of the numbers because I suspect that the sincerely held beliefs may or may not be quite what they can admit to put it mildly.
Well, I guess a wider issue or related issue as well is has such repression changed the attitudes of the Ahwazis towards, say, the outside world, towards the United States or Israel or any other countries? Do they look to the outside world, any particular country, as sort of a source of help, a savior, or a source of support?
Some certainly do. There are a number who look very favorably on Israel as the avowed enemy of Iran, although you'll still find others who, you know, sort of instinctively say, oh, no, no, they must be in cahoots secretly because, I don't know, choose your conspiracy theory. But, and I would say that you have a number who are or would like to be pro-American. You know, I mentioned when Soleimani was killed, let me tell you, there was absolute joy and the hope that it was the beginning of more concerted action on the part of the United States, which unfortunately has led to a bit of the opposite reaction since still happening, and the United States has not been acting since that point.
Well, that's interesting. What effect then did, looking back in recent history, what effect did the role of the United States have in leading this coalition to overthrow Saddam Hussein in 2003 have upon the Ahwazi? Did that did they maybe think like, oh, we hope that the United States would overthrow Iran, the Iranian Islamic Republic next?
There were definitely those who were hoping for just that. And I can tell you, you know, in circa 2001, 2003, I was actually studying Middle East politics and history, and I was part of several panels, mostly student-oriented, here. And we were all hoping that, you know, the expression that came out was, you know, if you have an axis of evil, it's rotating around Iran, which is its kernel. And so I know, just as I was looking at it from here, hoping that the United States would take action against Iran, which posed more of a threat, so too they were hoping that Iranian encroachment would be halted, and B, that perhaps the United States would also take action against Iran. And unfortunately, what we've seen is a widespread abdication of control and responsibility within Iraq, which has in turn led to Iran making significant inroads for a time at creating its what they were calling the Shiite Crescent, which of course was its goal. So, you know, there was some hope. I think there is still some hope, but at times like rather difficult.
Well, you know, one thing that strikes me, what particular views do countries around the Gulf have of the Ahwazi Arabs and this whole province? That, for example, it's occurred to me that there's sort of a parallel to the you have this the Shiite Arabs in this Khuzestan or Arabistan province, this strategically sensitive area for Iran. But then across the Gulf in Saudi Arabia's eastern province, you have kind of a parallel situation that's where Saudi Arabia's Shiite Arab minority is, and so there's always been sensitivity there that there could be unrest there in this strategic area for Saudi Arabia, where most of its oil comes from. So how do the Arab states in the Gulf region view this issue of Khuzestan and what it might portend for stability in the region? Where they might say, if we support any sort of autonomy breakaway effort there, then, you know, say in Saudi Arabia, you'll start to have people demanding, say the Shiite Arabs demanding autonomy or independence there as well.
I mean, that's always a consideration, but I think that they understand that the issue there isn't really a Sunni-Shia issue, but rather, you know, you have these people, and you can figuratively call them, let's say, cousins, who are being oppressed. They're not likely to spread anything. You know, if Ahwazis were able to travel to Iraq, they're not exactly going to destabilize, or to Saudi Arabia. I think the bigger concern would be what Iran would do. For them to provide any sort of support to the Ahwazis, Iran obviously would take action. And I think that's more of a consideration. But let's not forget, you have basically the entire Middle East, every country that's not beholden to Iran is dead set against it. So, you know, when I'm looking at it at least, you know, I would say this would fit into that general structure where, you know, most of the Arab countries certainly, and really almost all of the Middle East itself, you know, is united against Iran more than focused necessarily on potential, you know, breakaways.
Well, then thinking of the Ahwazi themselves, what sort of opposition or resistance efforts have they had against Iran and this repression? For example, I've come across the reference to this group, the Arab Struggle Movement for the Liberation of Ahwaz, or the ASLMA, if I'm saying that acronym properly. Discuss those opposition and resistance efforts that have existed among the Ahwazi throughout history.
There are certainly active resistance efforts. And if you go back far enough, there were outright revolts, particularly the 20s, the 30s, the 40s and the 50s. There were armed revolts. At this point, it's more along the lines of, trying to raise attention outside of Iran rather than being able to do anything in Iran. Let's not forget, it was only a couple of years ago where, the IRGC ordered the executions of a number of Ahwazis claiming that they had opened fire on a military parade. No evidence, no real trial, nothing that we certainly in the Western world would consider actual due process. But sure enough, they were blamed for it and, tortured. The predictable confessions then followed, and then they were executed. So, within Iran, I would say it's not a not a violent resistance, but it's definitely a very vigorous and sustained resistance, both within and without the country.
Yes, well, I've come across another group, if I recall correctly, the Democratic Secular Party of Ahwaz, which online I've seen they've made one spokesman was saying they were calling for a secular, a federated Iran, a diverse Iran. So there have been a multiple number of groups. I mean, this ASLMA is apparently, well, they've apparently split into two. One branch is based in Holland, and the other branch is based in Denmark. They've apparently been affiliated with some armed actions like bombings or such in Iran. Thinking about revolts in the past, of the Soviet Union, the United Kingdom invaded Iran in 1941 during World War II because they were afraid of the Axis sympathies of Reza Shah Pahlavi. Did the Axis powers, the Germans, ever try to stir up dissent among the Ahwazis to increase their influence in World War II in Iran in this oil-rich province?
I have seen some reports of German attempted incursions. I could be wrong. I don't believe that I saw that they really, found any route at that time. Just as, Soviet attempts just a few years later didn't really pan out for them, although they tried.
Well, one issue you mentioned briefly, perhaps, that's also come up a lot in the literature about the harsh rule of the Iranians has been severe environmental degradation. It's been known in particular, as you indicated, that the Karun River goes through Khuzestan or Arabistan and is the largest river in Iran. But as you noted, the Iranians have been damming it up and diverting the water towards other parts of Iran, such that there's been a lot of desertification or aridness in the region. What have been the environmental effects of Iranian rule over this area?
In a word, catastrophic. Desertification, you have increased droughts, you've got dust storms, you have deforestation. Ahwaz used to be the home to, notable date farms, and date trees in particular. It was the breadbasket of the region. Don't forget, this is just east of the Fertile Crescent. The Karun was its own, really life-sustaining source for generations up until, unfortunately, the modern era. And all of that has been systematically eroded. And I don't intend to make a pun, but erosion is really part of the deal. And, the Iranian regime actually compounds that issue by taking other measures, such as spraying basically petroleum byproducts on certain dunes, claiming that it will protect against further erosion, but really all that it does is damage the soil further and make it, impossible to cultivate crops there. And God help you if you try to, let your livestock graze over, soil that's been treated that way. And that's not an accident.
Yeah, I found it. I also heard read some reference that these Akwazi Arabs, part of their population as well is are so-called Marsh Arabs, like the Marsh Arabs among the Shiite Arabs in southern Iraq, and so they have a sort of similar lifestyle, and they're also then through this loss of water, they're facing similar problems that harms that Saddam Hussein inflicted upon the Marsh Arabs in the south when they were in revolt, and so Saddam Hussein resorted to tactics of trying to drain the marshes so it could better suppress these groups. So that was an interesting parallel there, I thought.
Absolutely. And I'll add, of course, because you raised the issue of marshes, you know, it was about a year and a half ago when one of the protests occurred outside of the port city of Mashur, where you had young Ahwazis protesting about, and actually, you know, in many ways presaging the larger Iranian protests, not just about fuel costs, but about a lack of work, a lack of opportunity. And that was one of the instances where the IRGC brought in heavy artillery and gunned them down in the streets. And as my friend Rahim and I sadly documented, you had a number of these young men and women who had been fired upon, made it off the road, and tried to make it to the sugarcane marshes that were right nearby. And IRGC forces fired into the sugarcane fields, into the marshes, and set them ablaze, to the extent that for a week afterwards, the people who still lived in Mashur, if the wind blew, it would still carry the smell of, you know, these people that tried, these young people, you know, who had tried to escape to the marshes just to, you know, survive the gunshot wounds and instead were burned alive.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned the recent Chinese agreements with Iran. Discuss that a bit more for our listeners, and what effect will that have then upon Akwaz?
Yeah, so for a number of years, you know, it's not a secret. China has been implementing what it's called its new, you know, Silk Road Initiative. And there are a couple of different names. Basically, it's a means by which China is creating what is a figurative new Silk Road to ensure that trade, that its economic development, and above all, its inelastic demand for oil are secured. And so for a number of years, China has been steadily exerting increasing control over the refineries and the natural resources within Ahwaz, with the blessing, however reluctant, of the Iranian government. And that recently culminated in the publication of a 25-year agreement that basically gives China carte blanche to exploit resources within Ahwaz. A lesser known corollary to that is Chinese ships have been permitted to trawl for fish in the Arabian Gulf, which has resulted in, let me backtrack. And when I say trawl, I mean dragging enormous nets that take up all the fish. And basically, we're talking, you know, unsustainable depopulation of fish resources. And they've been allowed to also exploit that. So this is all part of China's rather brilliant, to be honest, sustained foreign policy of shoring up all of its weaknesses and ensuring that it has consistent control over the resources that it knows it will need. So rather than having to deal with its potential rival, India, let's say, the new Silk Road Initiative will sort of go around India, whether to the north, whether to the south, using countries that you know, will benefit either from Chinese economic largesse or they have no one else to turn to, which is where basically the campaign of you know, sanctioning Iran, squeezing it until it breaks, was almost successful. Unfortunately, that left the door open for China to exploit things.
Yeah, I guess that that brings in a point of factor of what do we do about China, yet more bad things that China is doing, not just to the Uyghurs or to Taiwan, but now, or Hong Kong, now they're also helping to back up Iran. Well, thinking of the Akwazi and a wider policy towards Iran, what should the United States and other countries do for the Akwazi in particular, or towards Iran in general, to contain Iranian dangers and to help the Akwazi people?
Well, I don't want to be flippant, but the first step would be, how about doing anything with teeth? You know, the Mashour massacre that happened in late 2019, you know, it registered a blip. You know, there was a mention of it in, you know, the UN Human Rights Council, let's say. We had the administration sort of condemn it. But that was it. You know, there is no real accountability being held to Iran. And I think that's the first step. Enough, you know, mealy-mouth talk about, well, yes, we condemn this latest atrocity. Okay, well, do something. You know, economic sanctions will work up to a certain point. You know, certainly nobody is recommending military incursion for any number of reasons. But there are mechanisms by which any nation can be held accountable. It means that other nations have to expend some of their political capital to do so. That is really the first step that I would say the United States needs to lead on, because the European countries aren't going to do it. For any number of reasons, they're not going to be the ones to stand up to Iran and its backers. But for that to happen, the United States needs to actually confront Chinese interests, which unfortunately we've been rather reluctant to do.
Well, and do you have any indication what is sentiment among the Akwazis themselves towards sanctions policy towards Iran? I mean, have they really been supportive of this, you know, maximum pressure effort that was brought on by the by President Donald Trump's administration towards Iran and other efforts?
Absolutely. I mean, between that and the Soleimani killing, you know, those were some of the most encouraging things that I think people have seen in years. Unfortunately, it was not a sustained effort. And so now they're back wondering what's going to happen, because it unfortunately appears that the United States is just sort of giving ground, particularly to China and to an extent to Russia as well. So that jubilation, it's fading.
And I guess, you know, that thinking of the, of course, such sanctions have been primarily motivated by the nuclear program in Iran and trying to stop that. Is there any relationship between the Akwazi and the nuclear program? I mean, I guess there are no nuclear facilities in this province, so there wouldn't be any possibility of, like, Akwazi groups engaging in, like, intelligence gathering or something on the Iranian nuclear program.
Oh, funny you should mention that, because one of Iran's nuclear programs is actually smack right in the middle of an Akwazi city. Obviously, they're not going to acknowledge that publicly, because who puts a nuclear facility in the middle of a city, if you're a realistic state? But there is very much one. It's actually within Ahwaz on the Arabian Gulf Coast. However, in terms of spying, it's not going to happen, because the Ahwazis are basically excluded from any sort of useful employment that's coordinated by the state anyway. So, you know, they're not allowed to get a job in the oil refinery. They're not going to be allowed within 1,000 feet of the reactor, you know, unless something horrible happens, in which case they'll gladly throw them in.
Well, that's all been very interesting for a topic that often gets little attention in the wider world among Americans and the West, but yet a very important issue for dealing with the Islamic Republic of Iran, important factors to keep in consideration. Well, listeners, this concludes then another episode of Conservative Casual Friday, a weekly blog talk radio show with your show host, Andrew Herod. And you've been listening to Aaron Eitenmeyer, a lawyer and former research director for the Lawfare Project, who writes often about Middle Eastern issues. Well, Aaron, thank you for joining us and our listeners today on the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
All right. Well, join us next Friday for another episode of Conservative Casual Friday.